Workers. The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Do you think of yourself primarily as a singer or as a poet?
No, I think of myself more as a song and dance man, you know.
The Black Male and Queens Focus Group is an academic and social support network at Henry Ford College. Our mission is to challenge and change the accepted narrative regarding Black academic success. The Focus Group provides a safe, nurturing, and supportive environment. We help students navigate HFC and connect them with campus resources. Our community-based approach assists students in building relationships with their peers. The Focus Group exposes students to opportunities within and outside the college to promote their academic and professional development. The Black Male and Queens Focus Group is open to all HFC students. For more information, visit our website at hfcc.edu/BMQFG. Again, that website is hfcc.edu/BMQFG.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists.
It's Ideasphere with Dr. Stephen Perlman, America's critical thinking crisis.
I think that if anything, we've shown our children and our students to a great degree that education and what has been learned doesn't have an immediate relevance to them anymore. It doesn't have to be that way. We can study history as a matter of understanding something that happened and being tested on that, or we can study history as trying to inform what's happening now, what's going to happen in the future, in their lives, in something that's important to them or relevant to them.
Problem-solving skills. Most of America's students have serious challenges in that area. In fact, they rank among the lowest in the world. Research shows that their brain activity is higher when they're watching TV and sleeping than when they're in the classroom. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. The information just noted should be taken very seriously. This is the future of America, after all. When most college students fail critical thinking tests, it's time to press the pause button. Dr. Stephen Perlman addresses the problem in his book, America's Critical Thinking Crisis, The Failure and Promise of Education. He's an expert who trains educators and executives. As he demonstrates in his work, the problem doesn't fall on educators and Gen Z, but on a fundamentally flawed conception of what education means. Perlman has 3 decades of experience teaching writing and critical thinking in higher education. In 2010, he and his colleague David Carrillo founded one of the country's first and only academic offices specifically focused on campus-wide critical thinking. And he joins me for this program. Dr. Perlman, thank you so much for this time.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity.
I want to start right off with one of your comments in the introduction, and that is a provocative statement. You say the state of critical thinking in education is apocalyptic.
Yeah, I know that sounds sort of brash to make such a claim, but it's not mine. And all the research that we have on this, and my colleague and I have spent 10 years studying the peer-reviewed research on critical thinking in not just in higher education, but really K through PhD. And it's not a matter of opinion that it's apocalyptic. The clear evidence is that no one can make any association between the idea that schooling improves critical thinking at all. There are some studies that will suggest that critical thinking improves over the course of college broadly or high school broadly, but they can't necessarily attribute it to anything that's directly learned in the course material. It might be because people are just growing and maturing or what have you, but they can make direct connections. In fact, sometimes what we actually see are negative correlations between schooling and critical thinking. There are a number of studies that show that first-year or second-year students actually perform better on some critical thinking tests, just some, not all, than senior students, and they track that longitudinally. And all of the research that we have across the board, none of it shows at least anything we would consider to be a relatively positive outcome in terms of studies on students' capacity to think critically. There are some studies that show it's as low as 4% of students graduating from college have critical thinking ability. It might go up to about a third of the students, but it depends upon the study and how it's measured. But none of them are showing high percentages of students graduating from college with strong critical thinking skills or growth in college in terms of critical thinking skills.
This may be a little off track, but I can't help but think about what we were just saying and how it can relate to today's world, especially politics. And inside of all of that comes the reference to fake news. There are a lot of people right now who are not using critical thinking, and this reaches all the way into our Senate and representatives. They are not critically thinking, otherwise they would not be essentially promoting fake news.
Yeah, I think that the tie-ins to what we're experiencing today in the country are palpable in a lot of respects. And I think that there are so many ways to comment on that based on the research, but I'd like to speak to two of them in particular. In both senses, we've reaped what we've sown here. Our educational system, and I never criticize educators. Educators are working too hard for too little appreciation. And I'm talking much more about a systemic issue that we're facing in terms of how our nation is conceptualizing education than any individual educator. They all deserve much more respect than they get. But our educational system is predicated on the acquisition of knowledge, from an authoritarian figure who tells us what is right, and then who tests us on whether or not we, in fact, can regurgitate and repeat what this authoritarian figure says is correct information. And it's done in a process whereby, for the most part, again, these are generalizations, and I want to be careful to acknowledge that, but that it's done in a context whereby typically the students are relatively intellectually passive. The most severe example of that is sitting in a lecture. And what research has shown, they've put wearable fMRI monitors on college students and had them wear these brain monitors for a week as they've gone about their lives, eating and sleeping and watching TV and talking to their friends. What they found is that the lowest brain activity on the whole actually occurred while the students were in classes. And that's at the college level, much less at the high school or junior high level or what have you. Where we hope that students are starting to do more to contribute to intelligentsia and the intellectual world. So we see a system that's roughly predicated upon exactly what you are describing, which is accepting from an authority figure what is said to be right, regardless of whether it's right or true or meaningful or what have you, not questioning it, and in fact, being penalized for thinking otherwise in any respect. We have, as I said, reaped what we've sown in that first regard. The second regard that we've encountered this problem is in reading skills. And in similar fashion, students are typically encouraged to read to understand the main point or the facts being communicated within a text. That's important in a certain respect, of course, but what they're not taught to do is interrogate how well a text makes its point. How well does an author that they're reading interpret evidence? And I can't tell you the number of college students with whom I've worked who can't believe it when I say to them that they have the right to interrogate and question a source that's been given to them, that it's not necessarily a gospel truth at all, that it's someone's perspective and it might hold a considerable degree of value and then fall short in certain regards and be lacking and wanting in certain ways, or it might not be very great at all, but we have to interrogate it to find out, and they have a right and intellectual responsibility, in fact, to do so. So on the whole, I think what we're seeing is a representation of what we have sown in terms of our students.
Something that you bring out in your work, and I want to address that part of it, you weren't, as you say, trying to insult those involved in the education process, but you've noted in your work that many teachers, in America at least, have not been taught how to teach. they don't have that critical thinking themselves.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Not in the sense that they're not smart people, or even not that they are not critical thinkers themselves, which many of them certainly are. I know some beautifully intelligent people, of course, in higher education, many across my journeys in working with teachers across the spectrum. The problem is, specifically in higher education, are never given any formal instruction in how to teach at all. But then if we look at all educators across the spectrum, and I'm not saying this from my perspective, I'm saying this again from research studies on how we train teachers, as well as so many discussions with teachers who are facing Common Core standards that ask for analytic thinking or critical thinking, and say very plainly that no one's ever told them how to teach that. And that's the problem. It's not that they're not necessarily smart people. It's that no one's ever really devised a way to show them how to go about teaching critical thinking. Now, in part, that's not their fault, because the teaching of critical thinking really has been a conundrum for education for a lot of years in terms of how do we do it, how do we define it, how do we teach it, and then how do we know whether or not the students are doing it. That's a nut that really has not been cracked very much, and very few institutions have made a concerted effort at doing that in an accessible, longitudinal way. So let's not, again, point too much finger at the educators for not knowing how to do this when, in fact, it's sort of accurate to say that almost no one has known how to do this for most of educational history. On the other hand, we know that there's a pressing need for this, and we can see that playing out in society as well as in the world, where the rest of the world is moving far ahead of us in terms of including critical thinking and problem solving in their curricula.
In case you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Perlman, critical thinking and trying to reintroduce it to our schools. You have a website, blog, or anything else you'd like to pass along?
Absolutely. Love to direct people to thecriticalthinkinginitiative.org. Again, that's thecriticalthinkinginitiative.org, where my colleague and I also have our podcasts about critical thinking. And the Critical Thinking Initiative podcast is for educators, and the Smarterer podcast is for anyone who wants to learn a little bit more about critical thinking in their daily lives.
Good. I'll have that posted at Public Radio Exchange. That's exchange.prx.org. You can go there to hear this program in its entirety in case you just tuned in, and you can click on the links for Dr. Perlman. Again, critical thinking, and it's something we've lost. I notice a couple of things. One, you recognize what is essentially a complaint that teachers K through 12 are really overworked. They can't take one more thing into their curriculum that would be critical thinking. The problem with that is by the time you get to senior year, you're losing the possibility of reaching those students with critical thinking, especially considering a 16-month-old child, as you say, has the ability to have critical thinking.
Yeah, in fact, the research on children is quite extraordinary and goes even earlier than that. I'll share a tidbit with you that I think is fascinating. They've tested children who were just born, and they were able to show these children a screen, like a tablet screen, that had a number of dots on it. And they were able to play a sound, a repeated number of times, that either corresponded to the number of dots or did not. Although there had to be a certain degree of differentiation. They couldn't tell, you know, 14 dots from 15 dots or 14 beeps from 15 dots. These newborns could nevertheless distinguish between when the sounds correlated to the dots and when the sounds did not. These could just a few hours old. So we're born with this innate capacity to reason, and it's endemic to us. It is what has made us succeed as a species by far. And children do it all the time in their lives, everywhere they go, and everything they're doing, they're thinking critically, just not as much in school necessarily. We have to create school so that it's always tapping into our instinctive, not just capacity to, but actually desire to think critically. Our brain is so magnificent that it actually rewards us when we think and grants us, there's something called the basal ganglia. And when the basal ganglia is just confronted with information, it doesn't release any positive hormones into our body. But when the basal ganglia senses that it is solving a problem, and when the basal ganglia solves a problem, it gives us dopamine, which is our happy drug. And that's why we like thinking. We enjoy it. And if you or any of your guests have ever, let's say, forgotten the name of somebody, and it's driving you crazy. You can't think of that person's name as a celebrity, an old friend, or what have you. And then it comes to you, and you feel that physical wave of relief come over you, as well as the psychological relief that comes over you. That is your brain being happy that it thought through something and solved a problem that was bothering it. And that is endemic to us. We want to do that all the time in all of the things that we do. And we should not wait until students are in college or high school or junior high to start teaching them to think critically. We should predicate all education on that.
Build on what's already there.
Absolutely.
Which we used to do.
Yes. Well, in fact, and life does as well. Everything in life is a critical thinking task. And it's just not always that way when we're confronted with information to memorize or things to read just to say what they said. Instead, you know, as I say, a kid in a sandbox with another kid is a very complex critical thinking situation. There are emotions involved. There are real stakes involved in terms of what can happen. It's not an academic exercise. There's danger and reward involved. There's how to communicate with this other child. There's how do we play with the sand together? How do we get along? What do we build? You know, who gets to use the pail and so on. And all of that's a very complex, rich situation. Compare that richness and complexity of that situation to asking a student to simply memorize a date or a fact or who the first president was. We have these children who are capable of so much rich, intellectual, fulfilling, meaningful, socially relevant work. And then we have them in school and we say, well, today you're going to learn who George Washington was, who was the first president, right? And that's a bit of an oversimplification, to be fair. But nevertheless, it plays out, unfortunately.
It does. In fact, on this subject, you were talking about the monitoring of students and their brain activity is actually lowest when they're in classes. You note that half of the adult U.S. population grades an F with a simple critical thinking test.
Yeah, a very simple one. And unfortunately, the percentage who are then getting an A isn't very high. It's usually under about 5%, or it could be 2% or what have you. Not a lot left for the people getting an A or even a B on that test. And I think we can see that playing out. And the problem is that, as we said, when they're not training people to engage information and how to engage ideas, we're teaching them to adopt an idea or an ideology, but we're not teaching them how to interrogate it and think their own way through it and devise as many new ideas of their own.
Some of this, we, as you note, should be recognizing the parents are not participating. In fact, you have some information in your work that only about 1 in 5 of the parents ask their children opposing view questions.
Yeah, so much of what we do as parents, I think, and we got to push ourselves away from this. We have a tendency to want to make sure our children know what the right answers are to things when they ask about them, or that they're following our instructions or so on. But none of those things are in contrast to raising intellectually curious and intellectually agile critical thinkers. What we can do instead, here's an example that I like to use. If a child says to us, "Where does the sun go?" Obviously, we can scale this up for older children as they, you know, become smarter and more complex. But, you know, even a small child says, "Where does the sun go?" Well, there are two ways we can handle that fundamentally. The first way is we can tell them in whatever simple way we would need to relative to their age. And the second thing is we can say, "Well, where do you think it goes?" And then when they say, "Well, I think someone pulls a blanket over the sun at night," we say, "Okay, it's really interesting. Where's the blanket kept? Who pulls it over?" And so on and so forth. And it doesn't matter. And whatever they're saying, we just continue to ask them more questions about it. We have to do that with children, even when it comes to issues of authority and needing them to do certain things. You know, I certainly don't mean it when there's an immediate moment of peril and we need them to step away from something or they're in danger. But we can say, "Well, you have to go to bed at 7. And they can say, "Well, why?" And we can say, "Well, because I told you to, and I'm your father, and you're going to go to bed at 7 because I just told you that's your bedtime, right?" Or we can say, "Well, why do you think I think you need to go to bed at 7? And we can start to have that conversation and interrogate that process with them and still have them end up going to bed at 7. But the process is different, and it teaches them to value reason instead of authority. And I say this because there is a great deal of research that children who are raised in more authoritarian homes where they are given the answers to things, where they are told what to do. They're told to do what is instructed by the parents without questioning the parents and what have you. Show less propensity for critical reasoning than students who are raised in homes where their inquiry is welcome, where discussion is welcome, where reasoning through ideas is encouraged, even if they're contrarian and so forth, and taught to do that in a polite way and in a constructive way. So it's okay to push back on what time your bedtime is, right? Not every single night. It's okay to raise the question once in a while and interrogate that and ask about that. And maybe you could come up with a great argument that moves your bedtime from 7 to 7:30, if that's what you want to do. And if they do, that's great, right? All the better, because who really cares what time they go to bed?
My guest is Dr. Stephen Perlman. America's Critical Thinking Crisis, The Failure and Promise of Education is the title of his work. He and his colleague, David Carrillo, founded one of the country's first and only academic offices specifically focused on campus-wide critical thinking. Check out his website at stephenperlman.com. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rathbun. We'll be right back. You're back with Ideasphere and Dr. Stephen Perlman. His book, America's Critical Thinking, The Failure and Promise of Education. Dr. Perlman, an issue you bring up is our inability to recognize the value of a liberal education, which is becoming almost extinct because students are going for careers in lieu of an actual education. So you use the phrase phronesis, which is simply good judgment, but we lose that ability if we only pay attention to our career.
Yeah, the push on the career readiness and education as a vocational endeavor has been exceptionally damaging to education, and on a number of levels. First of all, pragmatically, it's just wrong. We know that right now what most of the tech leaders are asking for, and we know that many of what businesses are asking for are people who have degrees in the humanities because they have greater capacity to interpret situations and analyze them and communicate with one another and see problems as complex and interwoven as opposed to somebody who's just learning to code or what have you. Not that coding is a wonderfully complex thing. I'm representing what these tech executives are saying.
Sure.
Second, it's incorrect as well because we know that the research actually shows that people in the liberal arts often make a better living in the long run than people who come out of an engineering school or what have you. Not always. You know, if we look at the aggregates, that can be true. But the real crime of it, I think, is the idea that education is for the sake of getting a job. Education should be for the sake of pursuing new ideas and thinking critically about the world. And we've done a terrible disservice to children by trapping them in ideas that have already been thought, having them recall what other people have already said, as opposed to devising ideas that haven't been thought yet, finding the problems that no one has identified yet, solving the problems that no one has identified yet. That's the kind of people we need, A, who are going to be happier in their lives and more innovative and more secure in what they're doing and so forth, but B, also so we have a better world around us. The problems that are going to arise are going to be of great magnitudes, and we don't know what they are yet. And we need people who not only can solve them when they happen, but hopefully solve them before they don't happen, and we could do that more.
The second part of your book, we should actually pay some attention to this because you provide a roadmap for the reader. As you have noted, it's critical that we turn the corner and get back to the concept of teaching critical thinking. What you do right off in the second part is to make it clear that teaching is not just a science.
It's not. And as I train other teachers, and we spend the majority of our time on the science of teaching, but not all of it. And where I begin and end my discussions with them typically revolves around something I call the Mumau Clause. And this is based on a colleague of mine when I taught at American University. His name was Glenn Mumau. He was a writing instructor like I was. And he would sometimes have students come in for a conference. I'm not at all cool. Glenn was a writer. He's a harmonica player. He, you know, had this sort of almost 50s pompadour going on and wore a leather jacket sometimes. And he at about 40 years old, I don't know exactly how old he was, he toured the country one summer with a young band and living in their van the whole time. And he could have students come into his office for a conference about their work. And he'd take their paper and he'd throw it onto the desk and he'd put his feet up and he'd say, you know, that's really kind of a piece of crap and you didn't work on that at all. And they would kind of go, yeah, all right. And I would sit there in amazement because if I said that, the student would be in the dean's office, you know, a minute later. But he was able to pull it off. That's because there were so many alchemical things to what he was doing in that moment that are his persona and his tone and his appearance and his relationship with the students that I could never pull off. All so many things like that in teaching that are ephemeral and immaterial and we're never going to pin them down, and nor should we. Teaching is an art form. It's, and the medium of teaching, we don't work in paint and we don't work on canvas and we don't work necessarily with clay. We work with people, and that is the medium in which we teach. And people are the most complex medium of all by far. And I think people are getting a sense of that these days. I think parents who are home with their 1, 2, or 4 children and trying to help them in this time of COVID when they're learning online, learn a few different things and stay on task and so forth, should then have such an appreciation for what it is when a single educator has to work with a room of 20 or 30 or 40, 50 young children who are all heterogeneous and have their own emotions and developmental levels and interests. That's an amazing thing to accomplish. So yeah, we have a lot of science about teaching and we need to respect it a lot more than we are because we're really not doing that right now. But it's still always going to be an art form, and when it's done right, it's absolutely beautiful.
On a final note, perhaps, is the observation you make that kids now are not really following critical thinking, partly because of the mess being delivered by the adults. And you turn that around and say, why should the world be relevant to them now? Because we have made such a mess of it.
Yeah, I think that we've shown our children and our students to a great degree that education and what has been learned doesn't have an immediate relevance to them anymore. And it doesn't have to be that way. We can study history in two different ways. We can study history as a matter of understanding something that happened and being tested on that and so forth. Or we can study history as trying to inform what's happening now, what's going to happen in the future, in their lives, in something that's important to them or relevant to them. So there are things happening in the students' communities that are informed by history. And we could look at that more nationally or globally in terms of climate change has a historical, you know, basis to it, as much as does racism. Right? Or we can look at it very locally in terms of something that's happening in their school or in their immediate community. And we could look at anything in history, theoretically, and try to understand better what's happening now in our lives as a result and solve things today and make it relevant to what's happening in their immediate days rather than something that might have value later on in a test or might have value because they take a test and it gets them into college. It could actually also have value now. And they're still learning history. History is fabulously important. And I think that we've shown that we haven't paid enough attention to it by far because we seem to repeat many of its poorer elements, right? Mm. But nevertheless, we could also learn it in a way that is immediate and important and relevant to our lives. And therefore, they would also learn not only how to interpret history and think about it and apply it and change the world, but they learn why it's important and why it matters to them and to value history, which I don't think most people today value history enough. And I'm not a historian.
Well, Dr. Perlman, I regret that we've run out of time. This has been a terrific conversation. Thank you.
No, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a true pleasure.
It has as well for me. I hope we can talk again. There's so much more. I had more notes than I needed, but I really appreciate it.
Well, me too. I'd welcome any opportunities to continue the conversation, of course.
Lovely.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. Bye. My guest has been Dr. Steven Perlman, America's Critical Thinking Crisis, The Failure and Promise of Education. You can get more information on his book and work at stephenperlman.com and listen to his regular podcasts, The Critical Thinking Initiative and Smarter-er, co-hosted with colleague David Perillo. If you have any questions, write to me at ratfunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, exchange.prx.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Ratbun.
Boost your brain with the timeless game of chess. Studies show that it can improve memory, develop creative thinking skills, and lower the risk of Alzheimer's and dementia. Join the Henry Ford Chess Club today. All experience levels are welcome, and membership is free to any HFC student, staff, or alumni. Meeting times are every Tuesday and Thursday at 1 p.m. in the cafeteria in the M building. For more information, call the Student Activities Office at 313-845-9865. Again, that's 313-845-9865.
No smiles or eye contact at 6 months. No sharing of sounds or smiles at 9 months. No babbling, gestures, or answering to a name at 12 months. Little to no words at 16 months. No meaningful two-word phrases at 24 months. Those are just some of the signs of autism. Hi, I'm Dennis Brown II of Plymouth, Michigan. April is Autism Awareness Month. Autism can actually happen at any age. Other signs include wanting to be alone, delayed language development, restricted interests, repetitive behaviors, unusual reactions to sounds, smells, tastes, lights, colors, or textures, and fear of changes in routine and structure. If you see any of these signs, get your child screened as soon as possible. Log on to autismspeaks.org for more information.
It's Ideasphere with Ayushi Vig, Stopping the Mission.
I suppose if you're working in the nonprofit sector and think that burnout jobs are the norm, I especially encourage you to check out our toolkit, because burnout jobs do not have to be the norm. We deserve better.
We hear a lot about the challenges placed upon today's workforce. It's not easy. Compare that to those working at nonprofit organizations. The turnover is higher than for-profit businesses, the pay is generally lower, and burnout is common. Hello, I'm Guy Ratbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. Research conducted by the groups Stopping the Mission and All Due Respect has resulted in an assistance kit titled Sustainable Jobs for Organizers, Toolkit for a Stronger Movement. The material addresses burnout, low wages, low benefits, as well as stress, hours, diversity, equity, and inclusion. The authors do not intend the toolkit to be a template for all nonprofits. Rather, organizations are encouraged to use the portions best suited to their group. Ayushi Vig is a philanthropy coordinator at the nonprofit Stopping the Mission. Her interests lie in the intersections of human rights, philanthropy, and global development, and she joins the program this week. Ayushi, thank you for this time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am so happy you are, because this is a valuable piece of information for anyone working in a nonprofit, and after all, we're on the coattails of public broadcasting, which is always a challenge in raising funds. So we're talking about finances, funding, and above all, the security of the staff.
That's right. And I'm sure that people working in public radio are super familiar with this topic, as well as anyone who's ever worked at a nonprofit or who's ever worked in social services of any kind.
In your involvement, how did this evolve that you graduated and decided you wanted to go into nonprofits?
Yeah, that's a great question. I knew I always wanted to contribute to doing good in the world. And so in college, working at a nonprofit was really the way that was kind of shown to me as a path forward, as a way to work on the issues I cared about, work alongside passionate people who are committed to dedicating their lives to making an impact. And so I've been working in the nonprofit sector and philanthropy sector for the past 5 years. And a lot of my work, I feel like I'm always coming back to the conditions in the nonprofit sector and the role that philanthropy has played in creating these conditions of scarcity and actually developing a workforce that is under-resourced, under-invested in. And so you end up having these people who are really committed to doing good in the world and yet who are just burning out. And so that's part of what led me to staffing the mission, is curiosity about what can we do in the philanthropy and nonprofit sectors to really invest in the people who are showing up for our society every day.
Exactly what is this work you're doing? Staffing the mission is the overall goal that you're talking about, but what does that precisely mean?
Yeah, so Staffing the Mission is a program of an organization called Class Action. And our focus at Staffing the Mission is really to support both funders and nonprofits in thinking through what are the steps that we can take to invest in the nonprofit workforce and create sustainable jobs. We're in a period of historic burnout in the nonprofit sector, given the pandemic, given the multiple crises happening in the world, where I think recent research shows that around 2/3 of nonprofit workers have either felt burned out themselves or have reported seeing a close colleague impacted by burnout. And so burnout is a serious mental, physical, emotional health problem. And so Staffing the Mission really came out of noticing this crisis in our sector and wanting to support funders and nonprofits simultaneously to create sustainable jobs so that we can have a nonprofit workforce that is fully resourced, fully invested in, and ready to show up for the long term.
Speaking of the long term, we had 3 years of COVID shutdown, which affected every factor in every quarter of business, but especially nonprofits. Seldom heard about this on the news, but this was in particular a challenge because of an already trained staff, I'll put it that way, at least stretched to the limits. And now, coming out of COVID, the funding has dropped. In fact, public broadcasting in general has dropped about 10%.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really stark drop. And we're definitely seeing that across the nonprofit sector, especially in 2020, where all of a sudden funders were almost forced to be a lot more flexible in their funding. They're forced to move money really quickly, get it out the door, to be responsive to the needs that were arising. And so there was this moment in 2020 where I feel like we kind of saw this vision for what it could look like if philanthropy moved quickly, if money was actually moving out the door. And now we're in 2023 and we're kind of reverting to these old practices where it takes forever to get in a grant application, be approved for a grant, to actually have the money hit your account. And so there, I felt like there was a lot of possibility and excitement in 2020 for what the sector could look like. And it's been difficult for a lot of nonprofits to go back to struggling so much in order to raise funds, in order to pay their staff and to keep the lights on.
When you were first involved in this nonprofit sector, did you recognize readily that there were problems with the staffing, and it wasn't just the income, although that's a part of it?
Yeah, definitely. Income is a huge part of it. And in our research at Staffing the Mission, we found that actually the biggest complaint that a lot of nonprofit sectors have is not the low pay, it's poor management practices, lack of transparency, and lack of autonomy over the work. And definitely in my years working in the nonprofit sector, this is something that I've experienced a lot, is when already an organization is struggling for resources, strapped for capacity, time, there's not a lot of investment made in, for example, a young person starting out their career who's just learning about how to navigate the workforce and to plan out what it might look like to work in this field. There's not a lot of investment then in being managed well, in being supported to go through professional development opportunities. And so that's definitely been something that I've noticed working in the nonprofit sector and have struggled with.
Yeah, sure. And one of the things that we should talk about, too, is the lack of benefits, and especially those that lead to retirement in later years. Frequently in nonprofits, there is no safety net.
Yep, absolutely. There are a lot of nonprofits that simply don't have the resources to invest in staff benefits, whether that's retirement, that's a huge one, as you say, or even proper health insurance, which is so important here in the U.S. And it's often what becomes even more challenging is nonprofits have these mission statements about the kinds of change that they want to see in the world. And yet, so for example, if a nonprofit is focused on health and advancing women's health, to have their own staff not be supported to have health insurance is almost like a slap in the face. How can we expect staff to go out into the world and advocate for certain changes, certain impact that we want to see when they're not experiencing it themselves?
In case you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Ayushi Vig. She is the philanthropy coordinator at Staffing the Mission and graduated from Stanford a few years ago. Staffing the Mission has a toolkit, and in that toolkit are some very important pieces of information. Before we go there, do you want to pass along a website, blog, or anything else?
Absolutely. So if you would like to check out Staffing the Mission, you can visit classaction.org/programs/staffing the mission. And if you'd like to check out our toolkit, you can check out respectorganizing.org.
Good. I'll have that posted at Public Radio Exchange. If you're just tuning in and you want to hear this program in its entirety, go to exchange.prx.org, type in Ideasphere, and you'll find this program. You can listen to that and check on the link for more information. Okay, speaking of more information, do you have 10 really critical pieces of key areas that are attainable through this toolkit? It's not a fit one item fits everyone, but it is perfect for funders in their attempts to express their values.
Absolutely. And kind of like we were saying earlier, where a lot of people assume that pay and increasing wages is the primary concern of the nonprofit sector, the research that we've done with nonprofit employees over the past few years has shown us that that's actually not the case. Nonprofit employees have a lot of concerns beyond wages, things that can be improved upon in their jobs that don't require additional funding always. And so that's how our 10 key areas have developed in our toolkit, where we cover things from, of course, compensation and insurance, to things that are more abstract, like thoughtful supervision, employee voice, transparent communication, and caring workplace conditions.
I would imagine the most challenging is workplace conditions, because unfortunately, with most nonprofits, it's still in the old school of top-down management.
Absolutely. We found time and time again that that's been a significant area of concern for nonprofit workers, is feeling like they're able to have autonomy over their work, able to participate in decision making, and able to share their expertise. And so caring workplace conditions simply mean investing in creating a dignified work environment for all staff, no matter where they fall in an organization's hierarchy of leadership.
Yeah.
And so a really easy way to do that is just to acknowledge contributions of your lower level staff and to celebrate their work.
Okay, so let's say the organizer or director wants to be more cooperative in working with the staff, and they call a staff meeting every week or 2 weeks. But generally what they do in that position is to tell the staff what they're supposed to be doing, and then the meeting's over. Is there a better way?
Yep, that's a great question, because I'm sure that is all too common and sounds really familiar to anyone who's worked in a nonprofit. So there are a lot of things that a lot of ways that that meeting could go differently. First of all, the manager or the leader could start by inviting staff to reflect on what's gone well, what's working, what have we accomplished over the past week, and celebrating staff and using that as an opportunity to acknowledge and recognize their efforts. And then moving on from there, there's also an opportunity to invite feedback and reflections. Often the program staff are the ones that are working most directly on the ground with communities, and therefore there's a whole layer of knowledge and expertise that often senior level executives might miss out on. And so there's an opportunity here to engage in conversation around, well, what are you seeing? What are you learning this week? What are you learning that could better inform how we're approaching our work? And so guiding it to be less of a directive, here's what to do this week, but more of a conversation around, what are our goals? How are we progressing? What should we try differently? What are you curious about?
Yes. So with the situation that you're dealing with, not infrequently one of the biggest factors is burnout. You've mentioned it already. But that seems to be characteristic of the nonprofit organization. Why is that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Burnout is really seen as inevitable to working in the nonprofit sector, and part of our goal at Staffing the Mission is to change the narrative and to say that nonprofit jobs don't have to be burnout jobs. But a big part of the reason why we have these burnout conditions in the nonprofit sector is because of the scarcity that for so long the philanthropic sector has induced on nonprofits. For a long time, funders have been really skeptical to invest long-term in nonprofit jobs, staff salaries, and benefits. There's been this myth almost in the philanthropic sector, which is often colloquially referred to as the overhead myth. And the overhead myth essentially talks about how we need to keep overhead costs, so the costs of investing in the workforce, investing in the staff, really low, and actually spend most of a nonprofit's funds on direct programs and services in order for a nonprofit to be truly effective. But this is actually completely a myth, not true at all, because nonprofit staff are extremely critical for a nonprofit to achieve its mission. And so over the past few decades of this overhead myth of funders being hesitant to invest in staff salaries, we've seen these conditions of scarcity accumulate in the nonprofit sector, where in order to remain competitive for grants, nonprofits try and suppress their staff salaries as much as possible in order to be seen as quote-unquote effective.
Yes, and there's that stress that's always there. I was thinking if the burnout part of it is the stress of the situation always underfunded.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's really hard to show up, especially during and after a pandemic when everyone is overworked, underrested, hasn't had time to rest outside of the workplace, spend time with their loved ones, their families. You haven't had time to celebrate with your team the work that you've done. It takes a toll emotionally, physically, mentally, and over time that leads to people burning out, which is all too common in the nonprofit sector. I've had so many close friends, colleagues, mentors burn out over the past 3 years. And it's a shame because we really need, now more than ever, we need effective leaders in place.
Well, for your manager or director, whoever it is, their job is to try to keep the employees that they have, at least the ones providing the service that's expected. How do they improve their situation?
Yeah, that's a great question, because often nonprofits will throw up at their hands and say, well, I can't do anything until I get more funding. And a big part of our work at Staffing the Mission, a big goal of our toolkit, is to show nonprofit employees that there's actually a lot of steps they can take to improve employees' quality of life, even without obtaining more funding.
Okay.
So, for example, organizations can improve management transparency and provide supportive supervision without increased funding. They could also provide rest and extra paid leave after intense work crunches, such as through offering individual sabbaticals or organizational-wide shutdowns, such as for a winter break or a summer break. So in a lot of ways, constraints can be an opportunity for creativity. There's a lot we can do if we're willing to be flexible and experiment. It's more of shifting our mindsets around the kinds of jobs that we believe are acceptable in the nonprofit sector. And if you're curious, our toolkit has literally hundreds of steps that nonprofits can take to improve jobs without additional funding.
My guest for this program is Ayushi Vig. She's the philanthropy coordinator for the nonprofit Staffing the Mission. We're talking about the assistance kit titled Sustainable Jobs for Organizers, Toolkit for a Stronger Movement. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back. Back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, and Ayushi Vig, philanthropy coordinator for the nonprofit Staffing the Mission. We're talking about the toolkit, Sustainable Jobs for Organizers, Toolkit for a Stronger Movement. Ayushi, let's talk about that toolkit, because something that's important to understand, in these recommendations, they are just that, but secondly, it's not a one-size-fits-all.
Absolutely. That's really important to lift up, is this will look different at every single nonprofit, given your location, given the field that you work in, given the size of your staff, given what your funding looks like. It's definitely not a one-size-fits-all approach. And so there are opportunities to tailor this, and each organization is going to have to go through its own process to figure out what works for them.
Is there any work that you're seeing right now on the horizon for unionizing for nonprofits? It's one of the areas that really should be considered, but what are the pros and cons?
That's a really great question. We're definitely seeing, I think, a wave of unionization efforts across not only the nonprofit sector, but a lot of areas of work in the U.S.
Yes.
And it's really exciting because unions are such a great way to improve workplace democracy and employee voice and ownership over the work that they're doing. And so absolutely, unionization is an important part of creating workplace conditions that benefit all. I think at Staffing the Mission, we are fully in support of unions, and we also know that it can take time to set up a union at every workplace. It can often be a years-long process. And so in the long term, we absolutely see unionization as a way to address these issues. And as organizations, as staff continue to organize for unions in their workplace, our toolkit hopefully provides some steps that they can start implementing in the next few months as opposed to in a few years.
Oh, that's tremendous. Okay. Well, how about racial justice? We don't think of a nonprofit as having these issues, but apparently there is something to look at here.
Yeah, I am really glad you're asking this question, because there are a lot of racial inequities in the nonprofit and philanthropic sectors that we don't always realize. One way that shows up is philanthropy spends less than 8% of its grant money invests in nonprofits led by people of color. And so what this means is, not only are these organizations receiving fewer funds, they're also more restricted funds. And so as a result, staff of color in the nonprofit sector are often under-resourced compared to their white counterparts. And so if we take a step back, philanthropy has a really important role to play in closing the racial wealth gap. Funders need to move money to communities of color, and not just move money, but move it with trust in the form of long-term investments that trust proximate communities and leaders as experts on their own needs. We saw funders make significant racial equity and racial justice commitments in 2020, and yet in a lot of cases we're still waiting to see those commitments actualized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You lead a lot of workshops involving the toolkit. This is how you compiled all the valuable information.
Yeah, we've over time engaged in research and workshops with funders and nonprofits, walking through the 10 key areas of sustainable jobs that we outline in our toolkit, and talking through the practices, the different policies and ways that organizations can actually start to show up for their employees. So over time, we've gotten a lot of feedback and input, and hopefully as a result have created a toolkit that works for nonprofits of all different sizes, of all different resource levels.
What are the three or four changes that you think really should be made to build a better community of nonprofit employees?
Yeah, that's a really exciting question. I see caring workplace conditions as essential to any shift that needs to happen, because that's really at the heart of it, is wanting to create jobs that support dignity for all nonprofit staff. And it's more about the process of, if we engage in these conversations in a way that invites participation and collaboration and feedback, we will get to outcomes that we can be excited about.
There are hundreds and hundreds of nonprofits now, and I'm thinking back into the earlier years of my involvement, there were very few. But today there is a countless number, thousands upon thousands, which means they're all competing for the same dollar, and that makes it very difficult for leaders of the groups to assure that they're well-funded.
It really does, and it often leads to the sense of competition in the nonprofit sector amongst organizations that in an ideal world would be partnering, would be collaborating. And yet philanthropy really plays into creating these notions of scarcity. And so there are absolutely ways to counter this. For example, I've seen over time several nonprofits apply collectively for funding as a way to get together and use their platforms to advocate for their work to funders. And that can be a really effective way to counter what otherwise is becoming a really widespread notion of competition driven by funder-induced scarcity in the nonprofit sector.
Okay, so let's talk about how people get a hold of this toolkit, what they can do to learn more about Snapping the Mission.
Absolutely. If you'd like to check out our toolkit, you can visit respectorganizing.org. And if you'd like to check out Snapping the Mission, you can go to classism.org/programs/snappingthemission.
Great. Now, how are you feeling being involved? You're in a nonprofit.
Yeah, we absolutely are. We're a tiny little nonprofit ourselves.
Yeah. So how do you work on these things? Obviously, you're ahead of the curve, it feels like.
Yeah, you know, as a tiny nonprofit, we absolutely have firsthand experience with a lot of the things that we're writing about in the toolkit: difficulties raising funds at times, not being sure how to invest in staff salaries and jobs while keeping funders happy about the quote-unquote overhead ratio. I think at Snapping the Mission, we really try to build a caring workplace environment for all of our staff. We really try to, for example, be flexible in supporting each other's work hours. If someone needs time off, time for rest, we're really encouraging of our colleagues to be proactive about taking time off. And it's really wonderful to work in that kind of team environment where people mm-hmm. care about one another and our well-being.
Okay. Well, the absolute difference between the standard workplace and the nonprofit is that more is expected by the donors from the staff. And it's understandable. They're directly invested. So the stress upon the staff is, it seems, a little more challenging.
Yeah, definitely. I think part of it is donors shifting to see themselves as partners in this work and really showing up for nonprofits with curiosity. There's often a power dynamic between donors and nonprofit organizations. And there are ways for donors to show up differently to counter this power dynamic, to really show that they're here to understand the very real challenges that come with working in the nonprofit sector so that nonprofits can feel comfortable and safe opening up about these challenges. That can lead to a really powerful conversation where if donors actually understood the realities of working in the nonprofit sector and working in these burnout jobs, I think things would look a lot different. And so I think part of my hope for our sector is that donors and grantees are able to have the kinds of relationships where we can talk honestly about burnout jobs and from there can work together.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing. Any final thoughts?
I suppose if you're working in the nonprofit sector and think that burnout jobs are the norm, I especially encourage you to check out our toolkit because burnout jobs do not have to be the norm. We deserve better.
Good. Well, thank you so much. It's been great talking with you. Yushi, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been really fun.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I enjoyed it as well. Take care of yourself, and maybe we'll meet again.
I would love that. Thanks, Guy. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. My guest has been Ayushi Vig, philanthropy coordinator at the nonprofit Staffing the Mission. Her interests lie in the intersection of human rights, philanthropy, and global development. Check out the website, classism.org. I'm concluding this program slightly early today because I need to let you know that this is the last new installment of Ideasphere. I have mixed feelings about my decision, however, I believe the time has come. A side story. When I was young, I used to imagine having the chance to ask authors questions so I could better understand their meaning, the story inside the story, so to speak. I'm pleased to have had this chance. I thoroughly enjoyed the many decades of interviews with newsmakers and authors. I've learned a lot. My hope is that it's been informative for you as well. I truly appreciate you allowing me into your lives. That's also very meaningful. For the last time, for Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
That's where my baby stays.